This episode is brought to you by Adobe XD. Adobe XD is the collaborative platform for experienced designers to design and prototype engaging user experiences. Stay tuned to hear how XD helped me make a product I'd been trying to get greenlit for nearly 4 years possible. Yes, 4 years.
I think it's the most important product you're going to ever work on because it's your career, it's your livelihood, and you need to treat it with the same care that you give to the product you work on at your job or with your clients or whatever it is.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to this very special episode and part two of my four-part Land a Job in UX series. Today, I got to talk to Sarah Duty all about building an effective portfolio. Sarah has dedicated the last 2 years researching, interviewing recruiters, and learning about what constitutes an effective portfolio. So I could not have a more qualified guest on this show to teach us all about this important topic. Sarah will answer questions like, what do I put in my portfolio if I don't have a lot of experience? Does our portfolio need to be a website? Also, storytelling in presenting our work and so much more. So stay tuned for that. It is super good. Before we get to the episode, I want to let you know that UD Community is live and thriving. It's nearly 500 defenders strong. The only one missing is you, dear defender. So I want to invite you to check it out 7 days for free at community.userdefenders.com. After that, it's only $9.99 a month or $99 a year. So check it out, see if it's worth it, and thanks in advance. We are stronger together. That is a fact. Please enjoy this exciting and super enlightening episode all about building an effective portfolio with Sarah Duty. Well, greetings, User Defenders. I'm your host, Jason Ogle, and with me today is Sarah Duty, the one and only. Hi, Sarah. How you doing?
Hey, Jason. I'm excited to talk to you again.
Well, likewise. Yeah, and Sarah is a repeat guest, a repeat super guest, and I love that. There's a reason for that. So Sarah is a user experience designer and product strategist based in New York City, and she has done a lot of stuff. I don't need to read her bio again. It would probably take too long because she's done so much, but I'll just highlight a couple of things. She's an entrepreneur. She's created some incredible courses, and one of them happens to be on the topic we are addressing today, which is building an effective UX portfolio, which I know defenders listening, I know this is a really important topic for a lot of you listening. So I know this is going to add a lot of value. And Sarah has been doing a ton of research on this for a while now. I'd say probably several years. Would that be correct, Sarah?
Yeah, definitely hardcore for the past 2 years. And I think unbeknownst to me, many years before that.
Okay, that's what I thought. So I got the right person on the other end of the mic here to talk about this, and I'm super excited. So I'm going to officially say, welcome to User Defender, Sarah. I am super excited to have you on the show today.
Thank you.
So this is, again, all about UX portfolio building, and let's just jump right in. I'm curious, and I know a lot of the defenders listening are curious, what's the ideal number of projects that we should have in our portfolio, and why?
Great. So this is a question that I see over and over, and I wish I could come back and tell people an exact number, but it's one of those things where it's honestly just so subjective. It really goes to the idea of, you know, is the work that is in your portfolio providing enough evidence that you have the skills and experience to do whatever that job is that you are applying for? One way to look at it is to think about, you know, the experience of the actual user of your user experience portfolio, which is a little ironic, but you don't want to overwhelm them. you know, they are busy. They probably have a stack, virtual or literal, of portfolios to get through. So you have to be careful, you know, not to probably have 10. I think there is a risk in only having one, though, because you've only got one. And if they don't like that for some reason, then you're kind of up the creek. But I would say that you kind of have to use your best judgment as a user experience person to know, you know, has the portfolio reached the point of overwhelm for the actual user?
I feel like it's probably good to lead with your best project. Is that, would that be accurate? Like come in with like a really strong project that you have really affected change with?
Definitely. Don't be cute and save the last project until the end and think that's the way to go, because you read it online, you see it on Twitter, you see it on LinkedIn, where recruiters are saying, we only spend 60 seconds, 90 seconds, 120 seconds looking at portfolios on the first pass. And that is not a myth. That's true.
Wow.
And so you want to put that best one at the beginning to really capture their attention and then make them, you know, desire to see more of what's in your portfolio. And another thing I would add there is that I think we're going to get to this topic, but the idea of kind of tailoring your UX portfolio, and that can seem very intimidating to a lot of people because it makes them think, oh my goodness, I need to create an entirely different portfolio. And no, one way to tailor your portfolio would simply be to change the order of the projects. So maybe for one role you're applying to, a certain project is first, but then a different role you're applying to, you swap it out for some other project because for whatever reason, that one's more relevant to that role that you're applying to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I can see some defenders, and myself included, like I can see some of us going like, well, I don't want to spend time building like two different portfolios. Like that just seems like a lot of extra effort. Is it really worth it? You know, what would you say to me and defenders listening?
So I would say that it doesn't have to be as complicated as you think. And what I personally do, and I still have a portfolio because from time to time, you know, potential clients want to see examples of work, or from time to time, full-time opportunities come my way and I decide to pursue them and they want a portfolio. But what I do is I personally have my portfolio as a Keynote file, which we'll probably get to. But the beauty of that is that I have kind of a master version with all of the projects that could conceivably be in my portfolio. And then let's say client one comes along and they want to see some work. I think to myself, okay, based on, you know, the needs of this client, what industry they're in, what they are interested in me doing for them, then I choose those projects and I delete all the other ones that aren't relevant. And that's how I can maintain this idea of a customized portfolio, because I have one that I am constantly remixing based on the user.
Yeah, I like that advice as well. You don't have to like completely retool, re-engineer your portfolio. Maybe it's just like duplicate this code base. Like if you built it yourself, like duplicate this code base and just change a few things and just have a separate URL or something set up to lead to that, right? Like it doesn't, I think that kind of what I'm feeling already is don't overthink this, but don't underestimate it either. So there's like this fine balance, isn't there, in this process?
Well, yeah. And if you have to think of your portfolio like a product, and especially you have to think of yourself as a product, and you have to apply product marketing principles to yourself, your portfolio, you know, and frankly, your whole career. And if you look at what is really effective in marketing right now, especially digital, is the ability to customize the content and customize the message to the user. And so if you can speak their language a little bit more, or put the project that is most relevant to them closer to the beginning of the portfolio, then you're going to likely, or at least increase the chances that you're going to pique their interest and then lead them down the path of being interested in you, seeing the value you can provide to them, and hopefully, I mean, speaking in product terms, you know, getting to the point of conversion, where conversion for you hopefully means getting interviews or getting hired.
Wow. So you mentioned a little bit ago about recruiters, and I know you've done a lot of research and talked to a lot of recruiters as well about kind of what they are looking for and kind of what their process is in selecting ideal candidates for specific roles. And I am curious, you know, you and this was that was a sobering statistic that they only spend like 60 to 90 seconds on average looking at your portfolio. And and I guess I have a point and I have a question. And maybe I'm going to kind of lead into your answer a little bit, but my note that I thought of when you mentioned that was, you know, we just talked about leading with a really strong project and always doing that. And I thought about like the screenplay writing process, like with screenwriters, because I did some studying. I thought that like after I saw Napoleon Dynamite, I was like, dang, anybody can write a screenplay. So I was like super like thrilled. I actually was really pursuing it for a while, and I have a couple ideas. But anyway, like I just did some research on screenwriting, and what I learned was you want to open. It's the same concept, and you know, obviously movies cost a lot of money to make, so there's a lot at stake here. So you want to open with something that just hooks the reader on page one. The very first page, and I think some of the most memorable movies, I think we can kind of, if we reflect on it enough, we'll realize that those were the movies that started out with something that shocked us or hooked us within the first like minute or two, right, of the story. And so I think that's the kind of my little takeaway on your advice on kind of leading in with a really strong project. I think that, you know, what they say in Hollywood is you want to write a page turner, right? So because your screenplays are hundreds of pages. So if you don't hook the reader or the prospective filmmaker or your studio, so to speak, on the first page or two, then you lost them. Your screenplay will probably go away. I just feel like there's a lot of parallels to that. So that was kind of my little note. You know, you made me think of that when you were talking about the time. But I'm curious, you know, what's the number one thing that a recruiter is looking for in a UX portfolio that will keep a prospective designer at the top of the pile, so to speak?
Right. So based on what I've heard from recruiters at companies of various sizes, internal recruiters, external recruiters, recruiters in different geographical locations as well, the theme is that they want you to be able to tell the story of each project. And I know that is so cliche right now, and I know so many articles out there riff on this, but don't necessarily really tell you how to actually tell that story. But that's what they're looking for. They want to see, you know, your ability to communicate your ideas and to show and tell that story of each project. Because, and I intentionally say kind of show and tell, because one mistake that keeps getting repeated is this notion of just dumping screenshots and not telling people about each one and what they should, you know, notice or take away from each one. So that idea of telling the story and going beyond these screenshots. But another really important point to make, and this is more applicable for junior designers or people kind of entering the industry early in their career, is that your challenge is that you don't have a ton of work to show. You don't have a ton of experience. So what they are also looking for with junior designers is kind of the you factor. Like, who are you? Why do we want you on our team? Why did you maybe get in design? What are you passionate about? You know, what's going to set you apart? So thoughtfully thinking about and then being able to communicate those things should also be something that, like you said, is in the first couple of scrolls or pages of your portfolio to make it be a page turner, so to speak.
I have a listener question that kind of touches a little bit on this. And, you know, kind of what you were just talking about was, you know, in kind of being able to be real and how you kind of explain your story. And I want to get to storytelling too, because I think that's really important. But I feel like this is an interesting question related to kind of how to do those call outs, like you said. And this person on Twitter, she responded, her name is Catherine and her handle is at Kat J. Wynn. And she asked,
"Hi, Sarah. For someone starting out of school, what's the best way to demonstrate your knowledge and your thinking / design process?"
Right. So this is a question I get asked all the time, because if you are just coming out of any education program, one of the challenges is that you probably haven't worked on real world projects. You've probably worked on projects that have been just mock briefs that have been given to you. Maybe you've worked on some projects for, I don't know, some pro bono opportunity or something like that. But when you're doing something for pro bono, I feel like they're just so grateful and thankful to have someone working with them. They might not be as challenging or involved as a real paying stakeholder. So for people that are in school, what I recommend is, in addition to the experience that you have on whatever projects you've worked on, I always tell people, get into the habit of being a problem spotter, because designers today are so obsessed with solving problems. And I'm honestly so tired of the question in my inbox, like, how can I get more experience if no one will hire me? And I think, well, how are you going to succeed as a designer if you can't look around you and see all of the problems that exist? So I would say to Catherine, like, keep a little notebook, a note thing on your phone, and document all the problems you run into. Take screenshots, do whatever you need to do, videos. And honestly, after a week, you'll have so many things that you could solve. Now, the follow-up answer, because I know she would probably have another question, is, okay, so now I have these real-world projects, but from the perspective of a recruiter or hiring manager, that still is kind of fake, because, and I use fake in quotation marks, because you still don't know business information. You still don't know constraints about budget, timeline, etc. So what I would do is I would do a little bit of research to see if you can find any articles, data, etc. about that. So one example would be, if I spotted something in the Amazon.com checkout or something like that, and I had a bunch of screenshots and I thought, I'm going to redesign this, I would go and try and find if there's any existing articles or data about that. And one tip would be just to go to Baymard.com, the research company that's exclusively focused on e-commerce. And from there, you could probably find some data, or after reading a few of their articles, they would tell you problems that exist. And then you could have not only problems, but some data to work off of. And that makes a project then a little more realistic.
Yeah, that's such great advice. And I especially love your takeaway, Sarah, about documenting your problem solving. Like, that is awesome. Like, I haven't thought about that, doing that even personally myself. But I mean, we're always, you know, if we have a designer mindset, we're always thinking about how to solve problems, and we're always seeing problems, at least, you know. And so I think it's being intentional about using your observation superpowers, as I say, and actually like thinking about like, wow, this is a big problem. Like, how can I apply my design thinking, you know, to solve this problem? And maybe it's something really simple, and that's okay. I think that even just like, I'm not saying like redesign Spotify, but hey, if you want to, please, by all means, do that.
Right.
But, you know, I'm just saying, like, if you see something while you're out on your walk or whatever, in your morning walk, and even if it's like an industrial thing, even if it's, you know, architectural, like, I think that's really interesting. And I think that shows your diversity as a UX designer because, hey, you know what? UX is not just constrained to the four corners of a screen. And and I think that any, you know, a lot of recruiters and a lot of companies that are looking for really good, smart designers are actually looking for more diversity in how you solve problems.
I love what you said, kind of the idea of going beyond the screen, because you were talking about robots and machines and things. And I think if I think about the future of UX design, I think it's about beyond the screen and using our abilities and superpowers to spot problems, to connect the dots, to teach other people how to be problem spotters and things too. Because I think, you know, we don't need the word designer in our job title to influence the experience. And so I think as our industry evolves and as businesses start to see the ROI on design, our role really becomes more of educators and facilitators of allowing, you know, everyone else to contribute to wherever they influence the experience, whether that's in emails that are sent or social media or in store or the packaging or customer service or, you know, all these different touch points that can happen as someone interacts with your, you know, product or service or whatever it is.
That's so good. Because robots can solve problems, but they can only solve problems that they're programmed by another human to solve for. Right?
Yes.
I think that's really the key. We have that defenders. We have that advantage. We always will over robots because we can solve problems from a human perspective. And robots just cannot do that. So I love that takeaway. And I think that may be one of the biggest takeaways, you know, from this conversation. I think start with solving human problems, you know, from a human perspective, and then build a portfolio around that, how you did that. Because that is, I think, one of the number one things that recruiters are really interested in, and companies, and culture, company cultures.
Well, I love this kind of tangent of the robots and things. I have this talk I've done in the past, and it's all about kind of anticipatory versus automated design. But I use a lot of examples. And in one of the examples was about how I believe it was Toyota replaced a ton of people with robots and things. And then they actually went back to people, and maybe not all people, but a significant like reversal. And the reason was that, sure, robots might be able to do things faster, but robots can't do things faster and better, meaning that the robots could just keep doing the same thing over and over, but they could not look at what they were doing and think, this could be done better. And that's where the people came back into the picture of the factory.
Oh, so good.
I'll send you a link to that one.
Oh, please do. Yes. And we'll post that in the show notes, Defenders. Sarah, we always hear that we should be storytelling when presenting our work. And I certainly agree with that. But what does that mean? And what are the best practices for using storytelling in our portfolio?
So I think this goes back to our little tangent on the idea of filmmaking and Hollywood and things like that, because when you think about it, like, that's what people want to hear. You want the reader to feel like they have peeked in the, you know, virtual room, the design room, whatever it was, and they got to look over your shoulder as you did this. And so what you need to do at a high level is answer three questions. If your portfolio doesn't answer, or if a project in your portfolio doesn't answer these questions, and I think you're probably not going to do so well. But the first question is, you know, what was the product, what was the company, and what was the problem to be solved? And it shocks me how many people don't do this and just jump right into screenshots after screenshots after photos of post-it notes on a wall and things like that. But you need that context of the product and the problem. And if you think of storytelling and films and things like that, any great piece of work you've read or watched or listened to, the first thing that happens is, you know, some character is introduced. Whatever that character is, it could be a person, a place, whatever it is, but you meet the character. And in the case of a project in your portfolio, the character could be many things, but I think it's probably, you know, the company product that you were doing this for. And then you have to introduce the problem, because in every great story, the character has some type of problem. And then the third step, there's many ingredients to the story, but I think, you know, it's a character has some type of problem. They have this desire, and then there is some resolution, whether that is comedy, tragedy, whatever it is. And so your portfolio for each project needs to say, what was the character, meaning the product or the company, then what was the problem to be solved, what you did, the process, kind of the journey, if you will, and then what was the outcome. And if you don't hit all three of those things, then it just feels like, and probably literally is, a just dump of screenshot after screenshot after screenshot of like 30 artboards and sketch that no one can decipher. And it just is meaningless.
This is so good. This is like totally expanding my horizons. This is opening my mind a lot. I've never thought about it this way before. And I think that, you know, it's so fascinating. Again, the parallels to a screenplay and, and characters and story to building an effective portfolio. And, you know, and I'll just kind of, you just said it, but I put it in an order here, defenders, that this is it right here. This is the stuff. What was the product and company? What was the desired outcome? The problem to be solved, and how you help solve it. Bam. Mm-hmm. Right? For each project.
And then what happened? What was the outcome? Whether that outcome is quantifiable, whether that outcome was that, you know what, this never saw the light of day, but because I'm a thoughtful, reflective, insightful designer, here are some lessons I learned, or here's what I would do differently, or here's why this whole thing tanked. You have to be okay with letting people know about the failures, because I don't think I would want to work for someone if they looked down at those failures, because that's just the reality of design. Like, there are going to be failures. So that's another thing to consider when it comes to outcomes, because a lot of people will say, but this never launched, or but it actually didn't move the needle. And I said, well, that's okay. That's your job. Sometimes that happens. Mm. Mm.
Yeah, and I want to add on to that too. When you're writing your description of your project, like, I've seen some portfolios where, you know, you've touched on it already, but there's like probably like 20 or 30 images. And a lot of it is like, here's us like putting post-it notes on the wall, and like, and that's great. Like, that's important stuff. Like, maybe just one of those, not like five, you know, like just like edit your stuff. And that's really my main point right now is edit yourself, and think about, you know, use your empathy superpower to put yourselves in the shoes of the recruiter who only has about 60 to 90 seconds to actually get hooked on your portfolio, to actually read more. So think about it. Put yourself in their shoes, put yourself in your potential or your desired employer's shoes. And not just edit the images, but edit your text, because I've seen pages and pages, and it's not going to be read. You're using a lot of energy to write a bunch of stuff that probably is important. I'm not taking away from that, but you really need to go back and edit yourself and just, you know, what is it, Strunk and White rules? Eliminate useless words, right? Eliminate, yes, needless words. So go back, yeah, and do that. Spend, I'd say, you know, when you're, you know, time blocking the building of your project, I'd say schedule in the editing of this stuff. What do you think?
Definitely. And I would say too that concerning the whole editing process, one of the challenges that people encounter is that they end up working on their portfolio in isolation because, you know, you're not going to ask your boss for feedback if you're thinking of leaving that company, or they find it hard to get feedback, or they ask peers, which are maybe at the same level, or like friends. But my one caution is, you know, if you want really quality feedback, you have to ask the right people. And so you need to find either those online communities or those people that are going to give you, you know, helpful, contextual, and really, really actionable feedback. And I want to touch, if I can, on the idea, yeah, of kind of writing about your projects, because as I've been, I mean, spent ungodly amount of hours on my portfolio over the years, but packaging everything I've learned so that other people can learn how to do this, one of the steps in the process I recommend is that, you know, in the same way as when you're designing and developing a product, you don't just jump to coding. You have to apply the UX process. You have to understand the user. You probably are going to do some research. Then you think about your content. Then maybe you do some user flows and wireframes. And so for me, anyone that I work with, I say before we ever design your portfolio, before you ever open WordPress or Squarespace, whatever you're going to use, you're going to open a Word doc or Google doc, whatever doc, and you're going to write about your project and consider that the wireframe of your portfolio, if that makes sense, so that by the time you get to the designing and layout part of things, you've taken that little case study that you've written, you've edited it down, and now you know the story, the details of the story that matter to your user, because you said, you know, this editing process is so important. And I think there are definitely details that are probably very interesting about the project, but the filter that you need to use is, are those details interesting and needed by the reader? And there are details that you should include in your portfolio. And then I really believe there are details that you can omit, but have in your back pocket to discuss, you know, in an interview or something, because as we now know, you don't just want to dump the kitchen sink of the whole project in the portfolio because A, no one's going to read it, and it creates a very confusing and overwhelming experience.
So I've been trying to get an internal product built for nearly 4 years now, don't ask. And it finally got greenlit recently. The kicker? Due to a large business pivot on the IT side, the dev team has a very limited time window to build out the MVP. Well, thanks to Adobe XD, I already had the blueprints. I was able to quickly design, test, and gather feedback on my prototypes before the business decision was even made. So the next time your stakeholders or engineers like Howard Hughes say, "Show me all the blueprints, blueprints," you can confidently fire up Adobe XD and say, "Here they are." Don't wait 4 years. Download XD for free and experience design already ahead of its time at userdefenders.com/XD. Defenders, approach your portfolio like a UX project.
Yes.
Because it is.
That's
so good, Sarah.
To be honest, like I did not plan to have portfolios and things be like a major part of my business or anything. And when my inbox just got to the point of, frustration of seeing this question over and over, I literally used to email people back and politely say, like, If you are having trouble figuring out how to make your portfolio, I'm not sure that UX is right for you. But people kept asking that so much, I thought, you know, I spotted a problem. And so prototyped this out, and I've applied, you know, the product development process to this. And now, you know, portfolio creation for me is an actual like product offering in my business, which still kind of makes me chuckle. But when I get, you know, emails from people saying they've been hired at major places like American Express, Warner Brothers Entertainment, Home Depot, Google, Harvard, all these places, I think I'm just going to roll with this because it's working and it's changing people's lives. And I didn't expect this, but it's clearly something that is needed.
Yeah, exactly. And you're smart enough to know that when you start hearing the same questions over and over again from the same audience of people, wow, there is a problem that needs to be solved. And I just appreciate you for diving in and helping a lot of designers. And, you know, I see your tweets and, you know, and I love that you share that. Like, wow, you know, this is another designer that landed an awesome gig due to just some advice I was able to offer. And so I just think that's great. And I want to thank you personally, Sarah, for really helping our community in this way.
Well, thank you for helping me spread this message, but you made me think of something else I wanted to share. So one realization that's come out of, you know, sharing this process with people is that this idea of telling the story of your projects is not just about landing your next job. It's making you a better designer. It's making you be able to articulate your design decisions, communicate your ideas, present your work. And so that's feedback I've received from people that I've worked with where they say, you know, I have a great portfolio now, but now that I'm in this role, I realize when I have to present designs or research or things, I'm able to actually create this story and people are able to, you know, understand it, or maybe they're experiencing less pushback from those stubborn stakeholders and things like that. So I hadn't thought of that when I was kind of going down this path, but now it completely makes sense.
Mm. Wow. I love that takeaway. It's not just about landing your next job. I love that. It's making you a better designer when you design your portfolio, when you would build it and design it. Yeah, that's so good.
I think it's the most important product you're going to ever work on because it's your career, it's your livelihood, and you need to treat it with the same care that you give to the product you work on at your job or with your clients or whatever it is. But for some reason, I almost feel like we tend to treat it like a little side project, a hobby, and so we work on it when we feel like it or we don't have true dates, deadlines and things. But when you can kind of make this mental shift and think to yourself, maybe pretend it isn't even your own portfolio if you need to like mentally make that separation, but switch it so that like this is a real product. These are the jobs it has to do, et cetera, et cetera. And that should help you, I think, get over one of the big problems, which could probably be a whole episode, but this idea of like perfectionism. Mm. So that's just one tip that has helped me in things I do. But when I have people like make a little project plan with actual dates and things, somehow they magically do it versus without that, they'd been trying to work on it for 4 months or longer and it never happened.
Wow, that's so good. Yeah, there's something called Parkinson's Law, defenders, and what that means is tasks will expand to the time allotted. So what Sarah said is so important. Like if you're in a place where you're like you need that's the thing. Like, you need a portfolio. It's not a matter of do you. It's you do need it, especially if you're looking for work. I think it's good to have one anyway. As Sarah so well articulated, it's good to have one anyway all the time as a designer at the ready. And I think even be updating that too as you go, because it's a lot harder to go back and reflect and try to remember a lot of the details and storytelling we're trying to achieve here. It's a lot harder to look back and try to remember those things. So I think that's another great takeaway. But yeah, defenders, you do need a portfolio. And what I'm curious about, Sarah, is does it have to be a website?
This is my one of my favorite questions. So I would say no. And the reason that I say no is I don't know where designers have got it in their head that they have to have their portfolio be a website. But my thinking is that it doesn't, because you should make your portfolio in whatever format you can work fastest in. And time and time again, when I'm on the phone with people or in my groups and things, I say, why are you not finished your portfolio? And quite often the answer is, well, I decided I needed to learn how to code. Like, this was a great opportunity to learn how to code. Or I thought I should use this as a chance to learn Squarespace. And then I realized, it's not as flexible as I thought, or insert whatever portfolio website builder tool. And the content and the layout, and then as a result, the story is compromised because of the medium they selected. So I say, why not just have a PDF? Like, I don't know if there's a rule that says it has to be a website, but I say have a PDF. A, it's faster. B, it's much easier to customize. Then you don't need to create duplicates of your website and logins and all this stuff. C, it solves the problem of maybe privacy, or having work public on the internet that maybe you don't want to have public. And I think too, frankly, recruiters and hiring managers, I have asked this question, they don't care. They just need it to be easily accessible. So that's why I'm a huge proponent of the PDF. But I will say this. If you have a PDF, you still need a website. And I call it kind of like a home base online, because you know people are going to Google you. So let's just have some type of websites you can... And now there's like the PR person at me talking, but so you can control the story a little bit. So you can tell them who you are rather than them stumble upon random content and piece together an assumption of who you are. So remember the About Me pages that everyone used to have? Like, maybe it's as simple as that. Yeah. 1, 2, 3 page thing where it's just showing a little bit about your personality and then giving people a preview of your work. So maybe that's text that says some of the companies you've worked at or logos, or maybe it has a couple of screenshots of 1 or 2 projects you're really excited about. But then, now the marketer in me is talking, is you have a call to action on your website that says like, hey, if you're interested, contact me and I'll show you more of my portfolio. So now you've created a conversation with them rather than having a website or a Behance or a Dribbble where your content's just like out there, and then people might be visiting and leaving and you never get to have a conversation with them. So if you have the call to action be like, here's some of my work, contact me to see more, then, you know, it's an opportunity to maybe connect with some of those people and maybe get further down the process or faster down the process of hiring, et cetera.
Oh, yes. That's so great. And defenders, learn from me, because I talked to Chris Coyer, I think about nearly 2 years ago, and you can go and hear that episode where I was kind of almost bragging, like, I'm not going to use WordPress for my portfolio. I'm going to hand code it. I said that. It's documented now. So you can go back and hear me say that nearly 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And guess what? I think I started hand coding my website about 6 months later. And guess what? I still don't have a website up. So learn from me. And thankfully, now listen, you know, thankfully I haven't been in a place of maybe desperation where I've had to really churn something out quickly because I find myself in transition without a job, you know, and, right. and I know what that's like. I have empathy because I've been in transition multiple times. I've probably been laid off 5 times in my career. And so I understand that. But thankfully I haven't been in that position, but I still don't have something online that I feel proud to present. I don't have, you know, and so I think what I love what Sarah is encouraging you to do is just use the medium that you're most comfortable with that will allow you to do everything that Sarah has guided us into today in using our storytelling screenplay structure in presenting our work and our personality. Just use whatever is available to you that you're really efficient at and time block it. Set yes. some time, right? Calendar this stuff because what gets scheduled gets done. And again, you know, you look at me as an example. I never set a deadline for myself. I made lofty promises that I just could not achieve, and I don't have anything still. So I love that advice, Sarah. It doesn't have to be a website, Defenders.
No. And I always say, your portfolio is never done, just like a product is never done. You're always iterating it. So the first version of your product will be messy, probably be hacked together in the background, and that's okay as long as it gets the job done. So maybe the first version is a PDF, and then you decide for whatever reason, oh, I'm going to make it a website, or you decide to make a better version of a PDF. Like, that's another thing to think about, and that's another kind of piece of feedback I receive from people is when they say, oh, once I heard my portfolio is never done, that allowed me, it kind of like took the handcuffs off and let them be confident that you may as well start applying with version 1.0 and see how people respond to that portfolio and things rather than try and perfect it. Because during that process of trying to perfect it, maybe you missed out on 4 opportunities that the portfolio version 1.0 would have been just fine, and maybe you would have already been hired. But you'll never know until you launch it. Again, all these parallels of your portfolio being a product.
Hi, this is Nir Eyal, author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, and I Fight for the Users. You're listening to User Defenders Podcast with Jason Ogle.
Wow. Yeah, that's so great. And done is better than perfect. And yes. I think Jeffrey Zeldman said, good is the enemy of great and great is the enemy of shipping.
I like that.
You know, just get something out there. Yeah, isn't that good? Yeah. Just get something out there and iterate upon it. Isn't that what this whole field is about?
Mm-hmm.
Learning and iterating.
The other thing I would say, and you touched on it earlier, is that it's always great to have a portfolio ready to go, regardless of if you're actively job searching or not, because you never know what opportunities are going to fall into your lap. But the other thing is that I think as a result of creating your portfolio, this can often help designers overcome that all too common imposter syndrome, which I know we talked about before. But when you can truly look back and see the depth of what you did, and not just that you moved things around on a screen and put stuff on a sticky notes on a wall and all this stuff, but when you can present it in a more, well, when you can learn how to communicate those things, it makes you more confident in yourself as a designer. And that's one of the awesome transformations I get to see, where people who feel like, oh, I don't know if I'm good enough, or maybe I should just stay in this job. I'm like, no, you have awesome skills. You just are terrible at communicating them. So let's fix that. And then good things start to happen.
Wow. Oh, so good. I'm going to ask the kind of the Stephen King pencil question. I don't know. There's a quick backstory to that. You know, Stephen King is obviously an incredible writer. That goes without saying. And he's done, there's a story about how he was at like a conference or something, and And basically the number one question he was getting is, what kind of pencil do you use? What kind of pencil do you use to write?
Yeah.
Right. And and of course we have some incredible tools available to us. And I want to plug Adobe XD because they are a sponsor of the show and I use the product. It's an awesome product. Okay. It gets better and better.
Cool.
But you know, of course we like our tools, you know, we certainly do. So I'm going to kind of, you know, ask the Stephen King question to you, Sarah, you know, even though, you know, you thankfully stated that you don't have to have a website to effectively mm-hmm. communicate your portfolio. But I would say if you did have do you have any recommended services for assembling a portfolio quickly and painlessly and powerfully?
Yeah, so I would want to make a distinction here. So there's a difference between like having your own website like sarahdudy.com versus being on a platform such as, you know, Dribbble or Behance or something like that. And I think when you look at the purposes or the initial goal from my perspective of those platforms, it was really to show and show off like individual bits and pieces of your work, I think.
Yeah.
And now mm-hmm. these products have really started to evolve where people are trying to use their profile pages on theirs, their portfolio. But the challenge that I see is that the ability to tell that story may be limited by the tools that are currently available in some of those platforms. And the other challenge with those platforms is that if someone is on my Behance page, I don't even know if I have a Behance. I did at some point. But if someone's on my page, they are so likely to click away because they might see something in the column or something at the bottom. And so when they're on your right. own sarahdudy.com, you've got them isolated and they can focus on you. I wanted to point out that distinction. But concerning, so let's operate on the assumption now you're going to make your own .com. And I would say, I think Squarespace and WordPress are both great options, and it really just depends on how your brain works and your level of comfort with each of those. But I would also say too, for WordPress, again, don't try and be all cute and learn how to code and things if like you've never written a line of HTML, but become aware of like the amazing world of WordPress templates and themes and plugins that let you literally drag and drop things all over without even really needing to see the normal WordPress interface. Same with Squarespace. Like there's just so many great templates to give you a starting point. I actually did a partnership with Wix.com earlier this year where I created a portfolio template. And I also, because the educator in me couldn't resist, I also created like a YouTube walkthrough about, okay, here is the strategy behind each section. So it's like, this is why this is here. This is why that's there. This is what you might want to do. So we can link to that as well. But I think any of these are great options. I'm sure there's many other ones, but I wouldn't be afraid to use a template. So one thing that people say is, well, if I use a template, isn't mine going to look like everyone else's? And I say, well, no, because it's all about the content inside of it, you know? So
yes.
That's one thing. And then I also created template files for Keynote and PowerPoint that, again, are kind of like wireframes of what a portfolio in Keynote or PowerPoint could be like. And the feedback that I get concerning that is that it helped me not spend, you know, an hour debating fonts or figuring out how to lay it out or deciding the structure. Like the templates just allow you to focus on the content, and that's how you can create your portfolio, you know, 5-10 times faster.
Well, I love that. It's like a constraint, right? That allows you mm-hmm. to really focus on your storytelling aspect.
Yep.
I really yeah. like that, because I you know, as designers, you know, let's admit it, we just get caught up in the minutiae. We get caught up in the details, yes. and there's nothing wrong with that. That's part of our role, but it can certainly distract from us really focusing that energy on telling an effective story about how we help solve problems and mm-hmm. And also in presenting ourselves, presenting who we are and bringing our personality in. Sarah, I want to open this moment here for you to pitch. Do you have a portfolio, UX portfolio building course, yes?
Yeah. So in all the, you know, research I have done on this topic, I realized the best way to help as many people as possible was to package this all up into a program that would really walk you through, first of all, identifying who you are as a designer, because I think a lot of people struggle with getting specific and going beyond just kind of the label of, hey, I'm a UX designer. But to your point of, you know, personality and passion, you really have to do some work on you before you can make your portfolio. So the whole program is designed to help you get clear on who you are, because you're a product, and then create that portfolio that attracts the right roles and that provides evidence that you have the skills that they are looking for, and then hopefully helps convert you into interviews and offers from companies that you want to work at. So we can link to it, but I really believe you can get through the program in 4 weeks. I've had many people email me and say, you know, I finished my portfolio in a month and I was hired within another month. So this works. Over 700 people have been through it. And we will link to it. And then I also, because I know not everyone can afford things, I also make a lot of free resources available. So on my YouTube channel, we have a bunch of videos. And then also, you won't be able to join because you're not on Facebook, but we do have a Facebook group. That might change. But right now we have a free Facebook group that's just focused on UX portfolios and careers, because nice. I find there's a ton of noise out there. And so nothing, you know, beyond that topic is allowed. And there's a lot of people in there who've had great success who, you know, followed my advice and now have awesome new jobs or got a different job at the company they're at because they were able to show their value and, you know, move up.
And I was going to ask you if there's anything else you want to leave us with that we didn't cover. I feel like you've given us so much, but I want to open it up if you have any other, even like some encouraging words to some of the defenders listening who are like just really struggling. They're kind of pulling their hair out a little bit, like, and they're, I don't know, maybe they just feel like they're just feeling a little hopeless. Like, do you have some encouraging words for them?
Yeah. So for those people, I would say, you know, I would be the first to admit, and we say this on the page all about the UX portfolio formula, but it will not be easy. Like, this is not some magic solution to all your problems, because to create a portfolio, it's going to take a lot of work. But time and time again, I get feedback from people who literally write, it was so much work and the hard work paid off. And so you have to remember that just like with a product, you're not going to get it right on the first time. Your portfolio won't be the right on the first time, and you have to keep tweaking it, iterating it, editing it, and then also not be afraid to put it out there, because you will probably be rejected at some point in your job search. I definitely have over my career, and it's just part of life. It's kind of like dating. Like, sure, you're not going to like marry the first person you want to date with, probably, if you do, congratulations. But you kind of have to think, like, this is a process. It's not going to be easy. But if you can maintain a positive attitude and stay really, really dedicated and avoid that perfectionism, then, you know, you can do it. But if you treat it like a product, it's going to make it be a lot easier.
Wow. Oh, I love it. And don't be, don't be afraid to share yourself, share your work, share, you know, like, have confidence in yourself, because you're awesome. You are a bad butt.
Yeah.
And it's a family show, so I didn't say it the other way, but you know.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to highlight these outcomes. And like we said in the beginning, sometimes that is quantifiable. Sometimes maybe that's quotes that you got from the client or paraphrased quotes from meetings and things like that. Or it could be reviews or feedback from customers after you launched some new feature. Like, get creative about the outcomes portion, because it doesn't just have to be, we increased conversions by 20%. Look at us.
Wow. Sarah, this has been incredible. I am so thrilled that we got to have this time together, and I have learned a ton myself, and I'm just bubbling over with new inspiration from this conversation. So I thank you personally. I know our defenders are like, they're driving to keep your hands on the wheel, defenders, but you yes. know, like they're going like, yes, like they probably feel charged up to really attack
Good.
This and make this a UX project and just really put their all into this. And you know, it pays off. Like Sarah said, defenders, like this is one of the most, and I'm biased, but this is such an awesome career. This is such a fun career and work, and especially when you realize you're solving problems that help people and change their lives, like mm-hmm. how much better can it get, right? So you know, this has just been incredible, Sarah. I'm so thankful for your work and your research and your expertise on this. Defenders, check out Sarah's course. I'll be sure to link everything in the show notes. And last but not least, Sarah, I just want to say, fight on, my friend. So many great takeaways from Sarah in this episode. I especially love the ones about treating your portfolio as a UX project and the building of it as if you were writing a screenplay. Think about and open with the hook, inject your personality, and gear your portfolio specifically to the audience for which it's intended, which may mean having more than one portfolio at the ready. Tweet your takeaways, defenders. I'm at User Defenders, and Sarah is at Sarah Duty. And I know that Sarah would love to engage with you as well as I would about this episode. So many great things to think about and consider in the building of your portfolio. I want to remind you again that User Defenders community is now open, and you are invited to come and kick the tires. Check it out free for 7 days. Go to community.userdefenders.com. Join us. There is some amazing conversations happening and some awesome, awesome, helpful designers, defenders, part of it. So check it out. And I want to thank Eli Jorgensen for the astonishing artwork and Darren Goldsmith for the sensational show notes. Darren jumped back on board to help me out with season 6, and I couldn't be more thrilled and hashtag blessed to have him helping me out with this. So thanks, Darren. Thanks Adobe XD for sponsoring this episode, and stay tuned. The next episode is part 3 of 4 of Land a Job in UX series, and I am honored to have Andy Vitale joining me again to talk about interviewing like a boss. This was a really fun and super enlightening interview, and I cannot wait to bring it to you. So thanks again so much for listening. If you think of it and you're on iTunes and you want to leave a rating and review, I would be honored. I love you. And until next time, fight on, my friends. Thank you.